Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. This past June, State Question 788 passed with 57% of the vote, permitting the use of medical marijuana in the state of Oklahoma. Since that time, our state government, health department, medical establishment, employers, and consumers have all been engaged in a swirl of details around implementation of this new law. In the latest news, many large physician groups and employers, such as the two medical schools in Oklahoma, have declared that their physicians will not be permitted to write for medical marijuana licenses because cannabis is still illegal in federal law. Growers, dispensaries, and patients have already filed more than 4,000 applications for licenses since the formation of Oklahoma's Medical Marijuana Authority just last month. Here to help us sort it all out is Jackie Fortier, health reporter for State Impact Oklahoma, who's been following the story and reporting on it since the beginning. Fortier came to Oklahoma about a year ago from her previous post in Colorado, where she lived through the passage of both medical and subsequently recreational marijuana markets. She covers other health stories beside medical marijuana that we'll also discuss, including a bit about the upcoming State Question 793 about an initiative for big box stores in Oklahoma to have optometrists and opticians working within, as well as an update on the complicated and expensive situation regarding air ambulances. All of that with my guest today, Jackie Fortier of State Impact Oklahoma on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Jackie Fortier, welcome back to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just talk in general about where we are with regard to medical marijuana in Oklahoma.
Boy, it's been quite the journey, hasn't it? It was only at the end of June that State Question 788 passed. I went to a watch party that night, and it was fun. I haven't had a whole lot of fun covering election nights before, but that one was really fun. And it's really just been a whirlwind since then, and that's really because within 788, there's this specific language that says that the State Department of Health had to start taking applications for medical marijuana licenses within 30 days and then start issuing them within 60 days of 788 passing. So, I mean, that's really fast-forwarded this implementation of medical marijuana.
And the state really hadn't studied it, I mean, officially in any context. So, I mean, it was really fast in order to do that. I mean, in terms of best practices, there certainly were a lot of other states we could, I think, take lessons from. But this was an overwhelming, I mean, it was past 56%. And most of the money, as I recall, in the campaign was opposed to 788, but it still passed pretty overwhelmingly.
Yeah, Oklahoma Watch did a really nice map that shows how State Question 788 passed and failed in different counties on election night. So when you look at it, many of the counties in rural areas, particularly in the far northwest and the southeast corners of the state, a majority of voters opposed State Question 788, but counties with really large populations like Oklahoma, Tulsa, Cleveland, Comanche counties, they went heavily in favor. So I think that that is really interesting. And then you bring up the money. Unfortunately, we didn't get these campaign filings until after 788 had actually passed, and that's just because of the dates that they have to file. But 788 is not medical. Got quite a bit of money. Oil and gas companies spent more than $500,000 to try to defeat 788. The Oklahoma State Medical Association, which is one of the big groups representing physicians in the state, gave $75,000. The Hospital Association gave $25,000. And then there's other names on that list that you'd recognize. Arvest Bank gave $25,000. Cox Communications gave some money against it. But yeah, 788 passed despite very strong and well-financed opposition.
You mentioned that rapid implementation. So where are we now? I mean, I've been following the news lately, and it is hard to keep up. There was an article, a front-page article in the Tulsa World that basically talked about how most providers, and I include, I guess, myself in that. I work at the University of Oklahoma as a physician. So both universities have come out, and because they accept federal funding, have reached the legal conclusion that they are not permitted or not permitting their physicians to authorize these medical marijuana licenses. But then many of the private health concerns have also issued the same type of ruling. For example, St. Francis Hospital and the Warren Clinic here in Tulsa, because they also accept federal funding, kind of came to the same conclusion. But the article went on to list about a dozen different physicians or groups that will be, in fact, prescribing medical marijuana, at least here in the Tulsa area. So what's your take? Is that the status right now? I mean, that many big institutions are sort of frightened because of the federal, essentially, marijuana being still illegal on the federal level?
Yeah, and that's correct. I think a lot of the large institutions certainly are, and that's not unusual. We've seen that, you know, at a lot of universities and hospital systems around the country. Right now, there's the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority, which was created when 788 was passed, and they're under the Oklahoma State Department of Health. They have a list of physicians that have provided their information to the optional registry and agreed to have it displayed. Now, as a physician, you can choose to do this, and it's supposed to make it easier for your patients to get medical marijuana licenses, just an easier process for them to go through. And most recently, there's 48 verified doctors that have provided their information in the state of Oklahoma. Now, again, that doesn't mean that you have to give your information to recommend medical marijuana, but I think it is a good indicator that there is a small group of physicians that are willing to do it. I did a story on how the remnants of the opioid epidemic are circling around in the minds of a lot of physicians. And we don't really know what that regulatory aspect of it is going to look like, especially for physicians. And a lot of them who haven't been told by their employer, maybe they have their, you know, their own practice or doctor-owned practice, a lot of them are choosing not to recommend medical marijuana because they just don't know what the regulations are going to look like, and, you know, they just kind of want to wait and see. But there are certainly physicians out there who are willing to recommend it.
So as far as this process went, initially, I think there was a lot of, surprise on both sides of this issue with the strong positive vote overall. And it seems like initially the legislature and the governor both were probably surprised by this. And Governor Fallon initially had some pretty strict thoughts about what I guess she was recommending from the executive branch. And that was pretty decried publicly. Can you take us through that process as far as what initially was going to happen and sort of how it's evolved and where we are now on this in terms of the regulations?
Sure. So after 788 passed, it was a big question on whether or not the Oklahoma legislature was going to have a special session. 788 was a ballot initiative, and to be fair, we don't usually ask ballot initiatives, especially ones that set up whole new industries, to be the end-all, and that's not how it was envisioned when it was written. So the people who wrote 788 knew that there was going to have to be more rules in order to govern this new industry, and that's why they wrote into 788 that there would be a medical marijuana authority created at the State Department of Health to come up with those rules. So initially, after it passed, we expected Governor Fallon to convene a special legislative session so lawmakers could consider medical marijuana regulations. Because it was a statutory measure, the legislature had the power to do that. They still do have the power to do that. They just haven't met yet. So, and Fallon had, you know, she released statements saying that she thought the law was so loosely written that it would open the door for basically recreational marijuana, and that she had discussed with legislative leaders and state agencies the options going forward. And the Oklahoma State Department of Health released draft rules, which they had been working on for about the 6 weeks before 788 passed, which is an incredibly quick amount of time to try to write rules for the governing, again, of an entire new industry. So fast forward a little bit, and the Oklahoma State Department of Health, they took public comment on those rules, and they were very, very strict rules. They also initially had a lot of, you know, testing requirements and a lot of things that are done in other states. And then it was led by the Oklahoma State Medical Association. They had a press conference, and they said, hey, we should have, they brought up this idea of having pharmacists in dispensaries and also having a THC limit. And THC is the active ingredient in marijuana that makes people high. And that is not written into 788. Governor Fallon ended up not calling a special session after the draft rules were passed by the State Board of Health. And then at that State Board of Health meeting, board members implemented some of what was said at the OSMA press conference, which was that pharmacists should dispense medical marijuana. And those rules would have made Oklahoma's medical marijuana program the strictest in the country. And I've talked to other states that do use pharmacists to dispense medical marijuana. And it's actually a really interesting gray area with the DEA, but apparently in Connecticut, which is one of the states where they do, they have a really good relationship with them, and that's why they don't go bang down their door and arrest any pharmacists. But after the state Department of Health passed these really, really restrictive regulations, Governor Fallon came out and said, I don't think we need to have a special session. I trust the Department of Health to handle this. Then the Attorney General's office was asked to look over the rules by Commissioner Bates. He's the health commissioner, and he used to work at the Attorney General's office. And the Attorney General's office determined that the Oklahoma State Board of Health had gone over their statutory authority by trying to implement some of these things, some of these really, really strict regulations, like having pharmacists in dispensaries, requiring them in dispensaries, and requiring these THC limits. So they said, no, you can't do that. So the Board of Health at the Oklahoma State Department of Health met again, and they did exactly what the Attorney General's office told them to do. And they passed much looser medical marijuana regulations. And those are the ones that are in place right now and will be implemented as soon as people, really as soon as they get their medical marijuana license. So that's the basic version of where we've been since the end of June.
Thank you for being so on top of it, because it really has been a difficult story to follow. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jackie Fortier. She's the health reporter for State Impact Oklahoma, and she has been covering the medical marijuana saga as it has evolved here in Oklahoma, among many other healthcare stories. So, Jackie, where do you see this going? So the current situation is, as you mentioned, there's 40-plus doctors who have agreed to list their names through the Medical Marijuana Authority here in Oklahoma, and patients are definitely going and signing up, as it were, or getting these prescriptive licenses. So when will people, I guess, be able to legally get medical marijuana?
Well, people will be able to legally get medical marijuana as soon as those who have commercial licenses can grow it. I've seen a couple tweets from growers saying that they'll have a product by December. That's, I think, quick, but definitely possible. I think another thing that's really interesting to throw out there is more than 1,000 patient licenses and close to 100 business medical marijuana licenses have been approved and sent out. So there's 1,000 Oklahomans right now who have a medical marijuana license. I think that people are actually a little surprised by how many people are applying for licenses. Now, on the money side, we don't know exactly how much money they have made yet. They've had 3,137 patients, 19 caregiver, 466 dispensary, 678 grower, and 188 processor applications that have been received by the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority. So that's 4,488 total. Any of the commercial growers pay $2,500 to get a license. Now, that's just applying, but it's a non-refundable fee. Patient licenses are $100 unless you're on Medicaid or Medicare or SoonerCare, and that is $25. So a rough guess, though, just based on how many applications they've gotten, the Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority has easily made over $3 million. Now, the State Department of Health has estimated that it'll cost $4.5 million to implement the Medical Marijuana Authority for a year. And that's what all of these fees are going to pay for initially. But, I mean, at this rate, and again, that's a very conservative estimate that they've made $3 million. I think it's probably closer to 3.5. They're going to have this program paid for very quickly. And then within 788, it says that any money over what it costs to pay for the regulatory aspect of it will go towards 75% of it has to go to education, and 25% of it has to go to drug and alcohol rehab. And those are two very underfunded areas of the state budget. Now, medical marijuana is not going to fix any budget problems by any stretch, but it will be interesting to see how much money this generates. And this is even before sales have begun of the product.
Right. So this is just on the registration and fees alone.
Mm-hmm. And once medical marijuana can be sold, there'll be a special 7% excise tax as well. And that will also go towards the regulatory, and then it'll do that 75-25% breakdown if there's any more money left over.
One concern that I've heard expressed by people in conversations around this is that so many commercial establishments and, I guess, patients for personal use have applied already, and we're only in the very beginning stages of this, that the supply of marijuana will be, I guess, extraordinarily high relative to the number of people that are legally permitted to use it. Do you have any information on that, or is that just sort of speculation?
In other states, initially, the problem was having too little. So it's certainly possible, but patients who have medical marijuana licenses are allowed to grow medical marijuana in their home as well. It's a lot tougher, I've been told, to grow medical marijuana yourself. They have a lot of different things in these grow operations. When I covered this in Colorado, I mean, they're just huge operations trying to get these plants optimal as quickly as possible. So I have never seen a state have too much marijuana initially.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, in some ways, it seems like the Wild West a little bit. I mean, people are very eager to get into this on the business side and be the supplier and, I guess, consolidate the market in a sense and then go from there. And, I mean, so it'll be a matching. Hopefully, at some point, it settles out of a matching of supply and demand. And presumably, there's, at some point, maybe many years hence, some type of a steady state between people as, I guess, more conditions become indications for medical marijuana. Maybe it does grow ever so slightly every year.
And I think something that's interesting is in Colorado, and they have medical and recreational, keep in mind, but the price of marijuana has just plummeted. And that's after a few years they passed recreational marijuana. It was Amendment 64 in 2012. And then it wasn't until 2014 that they actually started selling it. And they had a lot of businesses, and again, it's recreational marijuana, come into the state. But, I mean, right now the price of marijuana is very, very low in Colorado. And so a lot of companies from Colorado and in Washington, it's very low there as well, they've seen like this market saturation. So they're looking to expand their company outside of those states. And that's why in 788, they wrote in that you have to be a resident of Oklahoma. And they wrote in these provisions to basically keep large corporations, basically, of marijuana out of Oklahoma, that they wanted people in Oklahoma to have a shot at the marketplace first.
Do you foresee Oklahoma moving toward recreational marijuana at some point? Or do you think that, I mean, we're distinctly different from Colorado in that regard?
I can definitely see Oklahoma moving towards recreational marijuana simply because of the amount of signatures that they've gathered for recreational marijuana in order to get it on the ballot. Now, that's a constitutional initiative, so it requires a higher number of signatures. And because they filed late, basically, that's why they didn't make it on the ballot in 2018. There was no nefarious reason. They just basically didn't do it in time. So it's definitely possible that we will see recreational marijuana on the ballot in 2020. And if this market starts making money, that usually makes people a little less wary of it.
Mm-hmm. And Jackie, you cover many other stories in addition to medical marijuana. And one that is sort of in the news and coming up on Election Day, November 6th, is State Question 793 about the right of optometrists and opticians to practice in retail establishments. It sounds fairly specific. Can you educate us on this? Who's lining up where on this, and what do you think will happen?
Sure. So Walmart and Costco are the big money behind the Yes campaign on State Question 793. We see that from filings with the Oklahoma Ethics Department. They would like to expand their businesses, and this state question would allow optometrists to enter into an agreement with the store. It's a constitutional change, so it changed the state constitution in order to allow this. Optometrists in Oklahoma are very much against it. They have come out vehemently against it and have for years. This is a battle that's been ongoing for a long time. They've tried to get this through the state legislature before and have failed, so they ended up getting signatures in order to put it on the ballot. And they made it constitutional for that reason, because they could not get it through the Oklahoma legislature previously.
So it's hard, I think, for a regular consumer to see the downside. I mean, so, you know, if I shop at Walmart or Costco and I want inexpensive eyeglasses, won't an optometrist or an optician be the one at the big box store selling those to me? Or is it the idea of outsourcing it to sort of the lowest wage person in a faraway place or something?
Well, yes. A licensed state optometrist would still be the one giving you the exam. And they would enter into a rental agreement with the big box store, Target, Walmart, Costco, whomever, and rent space from them. And then that handoff that happens between the optometrist and then the people who sell you glasses or contacts at the front of the store, that's where they make their money, and that's what they want to get in on. So the people who work at the front of the store would work for whomever owned the big box store, let's say Walmart in this case. So the optometrist would be their own, you know, practice and everything within the store. But all the people who work there and the glasses and contact sales would all be from the retailer. Now, the concern that the optometrists in Oklahoma have is they have a very large scope of practice compared to other states. And they say that this state question would potentially restrict their scope of practice because it allows for the retailer to enter into an agreement with the optometrist to limit their scope of practice. And it doesn't say what the retailer can limit it to. It's very vague language in the state question. So optometrists in Oklahoma are saying that that could lead to less comprehensive eye exams for people and that people wouldn't really know. I mean, if you go into an optometrist at Walmart, how are you going to know if you don't get a glaucoma test, for example, or something else that you should be getting? The state licenses the optometrist, but under this state question, if it passed, the retailer would be able to tell them basically what they can and can't do. Now, I spoke with Walmart representatives, and they say that they would only use this language to restrict optometrists from doing any laser surgery in their stores, because in Oklahoma, optometrists can do some laser surgeries in their stores. And they would want to keep that from happening. However, that's not what the language says in the ballot measure. So that's kind of the behind-the-scenes, I guess, thing going on between optometrists and scope of practice. But you're right. From a consumer perspective, it's very, very well-funded. They've got ads everywhere. I see them on YouTube all the time, either telling me yes or no. So I think it's going to be definitely an interesting state question to watch.
One other story that you've been working on for some time that is particularly interesting is air ambulance or medical air transport. So this is where various hospitals or private companies, in a sense, use helicopter air transport to fly critically ill patients from one location to another. And this is subject to the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration's reauthorization bill. And my understanding from our conversations is that this is under some degree of threat. Can you elaborate on this or where this is?
Sure. The FAA reauthorization bill is like the farm bill for the sky. It only happens every 5 years, so it's a really big deal. And they've kind of done these short-term funding things. So it came up last year, and they did these short-term funding bills to kind of kick it down the road. So the interesting thing about this year is that in the House version of the FAA reauthorization bill, the Senate is still currently working on their version. There's consumer protections written into it, and one of them would include breaking out the medical billing side of air ambulance bills. So right now, air ambulances are treated like air carriers. So they're like Southwest or American Airlines, and that's because of the Airline Deregulation Act in the 1970s. And that happened when air ambulances were really still in their infancy. And nobody honestly gave them a second thought. They just thought, yeah, they're helicopters. Some of them are planes. We'll just throw them under the FAA. Great, we're done. Well, it's exploded since then. And what's happened is that it's an under-regulated industry, and there's no price cap. But because they're regulated federally, states cannot cap their prices. And they're also allowed to do a thing called balance billing, which means that if you're in an air ambulance, and then your insurance company decides that it won't pay the entirety of the flight bill, or if you don't have insurance, your ambulance company can come after you as the patient for the remainder of the bill. It's called balance billing. And so you will get something when you come out of the hospital for like $40,000. It can be really, really high. And part of the reason for that is there's no price transparency. So you can request an itemized bill from a hospital right now and see how much they're charging you for each item. You can't do that with your ambulances. So under the FAA reauthorization bill, the House version, it would let states cap pricing, and then it would also require the medical side to have itemized billing. Air Methods, which owns two-thirds of the bases and helicopters in the United States, they own a lot of air ambulances in Oklahoma. They own Tulsa Life Flight, for example. They're a private company, and they are very much against this legislation. They say that it would restrict where they could fly because states would then be able to put regulations on them.
And so the presumption is that, for example, because air ambulance, you know, here in Northeast Oklahoma may fly to Missouri or Kansas or Arkansas, that if states were allowed to regulate it, that they could then say, you know what, it's got to stay within Oklahoma, which would be a huge restraint on their ability to, in essence, transport the most critically ill patient, but also a restraint on their trade.
Correct. There's also a portion of the air ambulance industry. There are nonprofit air ambulances. I talked to Greg Hildenbrand. He's the executive director of LifeStar of Kansas, and they're a nonprofit air ambulance, and they're totally for it. I mean, he's been in this industry for a long time, and he doesn't envision a state passing any legislation that would keep patients from where they need to go. That would not be popular by any stretch. But this is an issue, I think, that's going to come up again and again. It's got very bipartisan support in the House and in the Senate. It's one of those few times where in Washington, Republicans and Democrats both believe, a Republican was actually the one who put it in the FAA reauthorization bill. People are just hearing from their constituents about these balance bills that keep happening. And I think that's partially because you're getting more people moving to rural areas and to the center of the country because the East and West Coasts are just so expensive, and because there's so many air ambulance bases, because there's no control on where they put bases. So a really weird thing about air ambulances is that because it has such high fixed costs, that if you put two bases close to each other, the increased competition actually makes prices go up instead of down. And that's because it's really expensive to have a helicopter. It's really expensive to have a pilot ready to go 24/7, an EMT, and a nurse, for example. And if I put it in, let's say, Oklahoma City, and there's usually, you know, a certain number of people who would need an air ambulance or transport from one hospital to the other, you have an idea of how many patients you're going to have. And then you add another base. Well, they still have to cover those costs. So they have less patients to cover these same higher costs. And that makes the cost of an air ambulance bill go up.
Jackie Fortier, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And thank you for being the health reporter for State Impact. And thanks for spending time with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.